I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Clash of the Titans, terrifying Halloween Countdown Special!
Welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better on this week's first ever
Halloween Countdown Show.
In the red corner, why not visit Scotland? Its magnificent highlands, its untamed coastlines, its islands full of bloody heathens. Edward Woodward gets a red-hot lesson in not sticking his nose in where it doesn't belong as his Christian values are put to the test, and then some from 1973. It's The Wicker Man.
I could a tale unfold whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul. Freeze thy young blood.
I am here to investigate the disappearance of a young girl. Where is Rowan Morrison?
If Rowan Morrison existed, we would know.
I suspect murder.
Sergeant, I've already...
In the name of God, woman, what kind of mother are you that can stand by and see your own child slaughtered?
While in the blue corner, Scotland is out and America is in, as Nicolas Cage finds himself in hot wicker looking for his missing daughter on an island packed with a matriarchal society of neo-pagans and bees. Lots of bees. Sure, it doesn't have the best reputation, but is it really that bad? We'll find out, because from 2006, it's The Wicker Man.
Afternoon.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. I'll get it. Give me your hand!
Edward, I know that we haven't spoken in a few years. I need your help.
I need your help.
I have a daughter. Her name is Rowan. She has been missing for 2 weeks now.
So, what connects these two films, and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles
Halloween Countdown. Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Potters! Do sit down. Shocks are so much better absorbed with the knees bent. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Chris Tilley.
And Victoria is off this week, but we are joined by a very special guest and the perfect man to ease us into our month-long series of Halloween Countdown shows. It's the director of Fright Fest and all-round horror oracle, the brilliant Paul McAvoy!
Hey, guys, thank you so much for inviting me.
Hey, it's really, really good to have you here. So let's start with Fright Fest, because obviously I'm a big fan. Chris is an even bigger fan.
I'm wearing a T-shirt. Did you? Have you noticed?
I've noticed it. Thank you very much, Chris.
I came prepared.
Thanks, Alex.
Shock up.
So tell us, what is going on this year? Obviously, the world is in a very different place to last year. What's the plan?
Yeah, well, the deal is August, obviously, should have been a physical event, which is our historic 5 days, massive thing, Empire Leicester Square and Prince Charles. That didn't happen, so we had to do a digital edition. We are hoping that the physical edition is going to go ahead, which is due to be the end of October.
Mm.
But with the current restrictions, etc., that might have to bleed into a combo of digital and physical. So at the moment, we're just waiting to hear.
Yeah, we're recording this a couple of weeks before it goes live. And so, I mean, my advice would be just check the Frightfest website for the latest
check
news.
Out www.frightfest.co.uk.
But what's it been like trying to organise a festival during COVID?
An absolute nightmare.
Right.
Scarier than any horror film we've ever shown. We just have to get on with it. I mean, the community are so strong, the fan base is so incredible, we have to do something. And luckily, as I just mentioned, the August one, which we did purely digital, the online community was incredible.
Yeah, and it worked. So, it worked amazingly as well. I caught the last 3 days, I think, and it went very smoothly when those things can be all over the place, can't they? I think.
But nothing beats, obviously, the communal feeling of being in the cinema watching the best film or the worst film all at the same time and going out and talking about it down the pub. So things, if we do the physical, but let's hope we can do, it won't be the same, but it will be some form of a community spirit.
Yeah. Agreed. And you just said the best film and the worst film. Mm-hmm. That could be a good trailer for what we're talking about this week.
Yeah, it could. I was also thinking, when you described organising a festival in times of COVID as scarier than any horror movie you've ever seen, you do realise we are doing the Wicker Man remake this week.
Yes.
So
Thank you, Alex.
Yeah.
I rewatched it yesterday, so yes.
Right, because I did pick what I'm calling Pagan Punch-Up Pairing for our first Halloween Countdown show. We are doing a month of horror on Clash Pop to celebrate the greatest festival of the year, Halloween. So the clue I gave you last week was, Woody, are you okay? You're burning up. And Chris followed that on Twitter with, it's getting hot in here, so take off all your robes. both excellent clues. Now, we can't read out the winner as of now, because we're recording this in advance, as Chris said, so everything I just said hasn't yet come to pass, but rest assured we will make a big deal out of whoever won on Twitter, where we are at ClashPod. So shall we discuss the connections to this pairing that I've picked? And for the first time ever, I think this section could be described as the obsolete section.
Is this the first time we've done a remake and an original? Because we did talk about that right at the start.
We did.
When we were coming up with the idea of Clash of the Titles. So I'm surprised it's taken us this long, and we've picked so diametrically opposed films of quality. But I did...
I disagree. I'm going to say it now. I disagree.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of the original Wicker Man, aren't you?
I do like it, yeah.
Vicky described it to me as your favourite horror movie of all time. Is that true?
Let's not show our cards.
All right.
All right. Sorry. Jeez. But that's a cracking clue.
Right. I found quite a... You have to get into the right mindset for the Wicker Man remake.
I was just saying to Paul on the walk here that I really hope Alex doesn't like it, because I think we can have much more fun. Because it's not a film that everyone likes, you know. There's a lot of weird in this film. There's a lot to challenge.
So this is the original you're talking
about?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah. Let's get into it. Does anyone have a connection that I might not have written in front of me?
Based on something we did a couple of weeks ago, we could have paired this with Interstellar, because they're both films about crops failing.
yeah, we could have done that. Would be interesting.
Both films with very different director's cuts, which we're going to get into on both fronts, because they totally changed the movie when you see the director's cuts. One thing that connects them is the name of the islands, but you know that they're slightly different, the names.
Yeah, I had to go through my entire notes and rejig them, because I was going to read it out.
Yeah, Summer Isle and Summer's Isle.
Summer's Isle. So, yeah, and I listened to the Neil LaBute commentary, because it was he wrote and directed the remake, and he says that he decided to change Summer Isle to Summer's Isle because he thought it sounded better and was way easier to say. He then proceeds to get it wrong on multiple occasions on the commentary, completely contradicting himself.
While we're on the subject of pronunciation, you're going for Neil LaBute. I've been in my head Neil LaBute.
I would say LaBute.
Okay, great.
Well, not LaBute.
No.
LaBute.
LaBute.
Neil LaBute.
Yeah, we're going for Neil LaBute, but I'm not going to tell you how to pronounce it. You want to go for Neil LaBute?
I didn't realise I'd done that.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Neil LaBute.
LaBute. Yeah, okay, good, good. Just checking. Just checking. I want us all to be on the same page until we actually get into major disagreements about these films. Chris, I gave you the original Wicker Man.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria isn't here. She had the remake. If she is not back on Thursday, then I will be dealing with that. But in the meantime, Chris, take us on a journey.
You've spoiled my introduction, Alex, because you used my opening line in your introduction as well.
Which was what?
Do sit down, listener, as shocks are so much better absorbed with the knees bent. This is the story of the original 40-year-old virgin, a deeply religious police officer who journeys to a Scottish island in search of a missing girl called Rowan Morrison. Sergeant Howie hunts for Rowan, but the locals claim there is no girl. He finds Rowan's grave, but there is no body.
I understand you're looking for a missing girl.
I found her.
Splendid.
In her grave. Your lordship is a justice of the peace. I need your permission to exhume her body, have it transported to the mainland for a pathologist's report.
You suspect foul play?
I suspect murder and conspiracy to murder.
The island tempts him with sex, but he rebuffs the advances of Britt Eklund's stunt bum. Then the locals suggest he leave, but Howie does not, because the sergeant believes that Rowan will be murdered to appease the ancient gods for the next harvest. But the joke is on him, as Rowan is alive and well. Instead, Howie is the island's intended victim, a virginal, God-fearing man who has come of his own free will, a lawman who possesses the power of a king, and a fool whom they've led on a merry dance. And so Howie is introduced to his fiery fate, burning alive in the Wicker Man.
A rare gift these days. A martyr's death. Come, it is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
You are the fool, Mr. Howie.
You're liars. You are despicable little liars.
So I've done quite a detailed synopsis there because I'm going to talk through this film in a slightly different way when we get to it. Maybe not so plot focused. But Paul, when was the first time you saw The Wicker Man? What's your history with this film?
I think I must have seen it in my very early teens. It scared me. I mean, it, even rewatching it yesterday, the ending is just so terrifying.
Mm.
And you kind of... There's all the camp stuff, which we'll get to, the camp stuff and the music stuff. The final images of the film are devastating. So,
and was this a video watch for you, or did you see it in a cinema?
Definitely a video watch.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, one of the interesting things about the film in the UK was it came out as a double bill with my absolute favourite horror film of all time, Don't Look Now.
Mm.
And what a night out at the cinema that must have been.
I know!
For couples, or, you know, fancy coming to see a film of the pictures. Yeah, we're going to see Wicker Man, the most downbeat ending. Oh, followed by Don't Look Now, even bleaker. What a double bill.
Yeah, although it wasn't meant to be. Well, it was only a double bill because no one had any faith in the Wicker Man, so they stuck it with Don't Look Now.
Yeah.
Which is, apparently it was even doubly offensive because at the point where they did that, they'd stopped doing A-B movies. That template for how they released horror movies had ended, and then they brought it back because The Wicker Man, they had so little faith in.
How about you, Alex?
First watch
for me.
Yeah, wow. Which is a shame. Because for exactly the reason that you just sort of described first seeing that ending, I didn't have that because obviously in the previous decades, it has dawned on me the information that he dies a fiery death in The Wicker Man at the end. So knowing that kind of ruins the punchline to a very long setup to a joke because you're I kind of know what's going to happen in the end. I did try and imagine what it was like seeing that for the first time, having had no idea that that was going to happen. And I think it would have been mind-blowing.
Did you not find the imagery at the end disturbing, though, when he sees the Wicker Man in its glory for the first time?
Yeah. I think what the clever thing they do the first time you watch it, though, if you don't know, is you think you're one step ahead of the locals like Howie does. You're on that trail for Rowan. And so that's they kind of throw you off a little bit there, even though they're giving you all the clues watching it a second time.
Yeah.
And I think it is a shame, actually. If you look at posters, video covers, they're all showing you the final image.
Yeah.
And it's a huge spoiler. So yeah. I am kind of sad that I think a lot of people coming to this film now will know what's coming, or God forbid, will have seen the Nick Cage one first and spoiled on that front.
But no, I didn't do that. I did watch them back to back, but right. I watched them original, then remake, which was a sort of really hellish experience for numerous reasons, which we'll get into. But that bit that you mentioned where Edward Woodward's face, when he sees the Wicker Man.
And the conviction of his acting in those final sequences, you know, the Lord's my shepherd and all that kind of stuff.
Because he'd never seen it, though. Apparently he'd never seen the Wicker Man. He'd been shown drawings of it, but they wanted to reveal the actual giant Wicker Man that they'd built to him.
Which is the conceit they used, obviously, for Alien.
Right.
Your favourite film. So they kept a lot of stuff in the smoke and mirrors until the reveal. So
yeah.
What a brilliant thing.
So let's talk a bit about the background to this film. Studio Canal brought out a Blu-ray a few years ago that's got a couple of great documentaries on it, The Wicker Man Enigma and Burnt Offerings, presented by Mark Kermode, and there's some great commentaries, and there's a great book about The Wicker Man, so there's lots of information out there. I've tried to pull together the best of it because it has got quite a dense history, as Ingrid Pitt, who plays the librarian in it.
I'm interested to see how you do this, because I tried to do a little bit of reading around this, and then I went, good luck, Chris. It's just pages and pages and there's Bibles on this.
She says that there's a black cloud that hangs over this film, and it did from the very beginning. And it's certainly one of the British film industry's most colourful making of stories. There's sort of lies and deception, but everyone involved said it was a film that couldn't be contained. But it started with a consortium of sorts. It kicked off really with Christopher Lee. He felt typecast in the Hammer horror films. He'd just done his swinging 60s Dracula movie, Dracula AD 72, and he just had enough. But he thought he could use his cachet to make something a bit more interesting. So he set up a consortium with writer Anthony Schaefer, producer Peter Snell, and director Robin Hardy. And they purchased the rights to a book called Ritual by David Pinner. And that's about a Puritan policeman who is called to a village in Cornwall to investigate what appears to be the ritual murder of a young girl. Have you ever read Ritual?
No.
I've seen The Ritual.
It's not that.
Right, cool.
But this one was much more about Satanism. And it's funny. You know what? In all these documentaries, everyone is disagreeing with each other, which is interesting. And so,
Who've you gone with then? Have you picked a favourite? You've gone, I trust him the most,
well,
or her.
They've used Pinner's plot, but Schaefer says that it was the book didn't work. I built on his idea. It has nothing to do with this book. But what I just said is basically the synopsis for The Wicker Man. But he decided to make it about paganism and sacrifice. He studied the May Day festivals, used their rituals in his script. He found an illustration in a book that inspired the finale. Whether that stuff really happened in the past or not, he thought, doesn't matter, I've got it. This is what I need. But he also wanted to dress it up as a detective story because Anthony Schaefer wrote Sleuth. And Sleuth is, you know, a famous old film with Laurence Olivier, Michael Caine, that plays games with its characters and games with its audience. And so he turned The Wicker Man into a game with the entire community playing that trick on Howie and the audience, which certainly worked on me the first time I saw it. I guess it worked on you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Saw right through it, yeah. From the get-go, I was like, no way, he's going to die at the end. Obvious.
There's not much to the casting of the film because Lee was there from the beginning. But Peter Cushing is the interesting thing. He was wanted for Howie. But due to other commitments, he couldn't do it. And I think that would have been weird watching a Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee
double, because you've seen him so many times in so many other roles.
Yeah.
I read also on one of the many sites that may or may not be the truth, because like you say, it's almost difficult to work out what the truth is with this film. David Hemmings and Michael York were also considered for the role of Howie.
Yeah, I could see it. Mm. But Callan was big at the time, the TV series, of which I watched my first ever episode this week as research. Mm. Very slow. TV's changed a lot. But Edward Woodward was bordering on a household name, and so they cast him. And Britt Eklund is maybe the other most interesting person. She was a big celebrity at the time because of her marriage to Peter Sellers. They said she looked the part of Willow but didn't sound the part, so they dubbed her. Although the director says we didn't dub her entirely, but if you watch the film, they did dub her entirely.
Yeah, that's one of the worst parts about it, because her dubbing is bad. Mm. Really bad. Like, so it's one of those dubbings where it's so noticeable that you're like, what's that's so...
It almost adds to the off-kilter nature of the film, though, I think.
Because Ingrid Pitt's dubbed in it as well.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah. And obviously we're going to get to Brett's bum.
Yeah.
Which is also dubbed.
What's quite good, though, about Britt Eklund, she's been very vocal about it, so there's plenty of stuff to talk about there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to get onto that with the locations, because they shot the movie in Dumfries and Galloway in Scotland, which Britt called the most dismal place in creation, which apparently did not ingratiate her with the locals, and the producers had to apologise for her words.
And she also added that she found the town to be full of hard drinking and illegitimacy.
Sounds all right.
But it's supposed to take place in the build-up to May, the Wicker Man in May, rather. It's supposed to be spring, supposed to be blossoms on the tree, fertility in the air. So they shot it in Scotland in October, meaning they had rain, sleet, snow and knee-deep mud. So they spent the whole of the shoot chasing the sun. They had people running around with apple trees behind the camera to get in front of it. And apparently the director said they put ice in the extras' mouths so they wouldn't steam.
An old school technique, yeah. It's true. That's what they were going to do on Titanic before Jim Cameron had the technology to remove it all with CGI.
And
add it with CGI, sorry, yeah.
And Exorcist, they did the opposite. They refrigerated the set, didn't they, in The Exorcist?
When I was a zombie in Land of the Dead...
Oh, this doesn't come up very often.
We have a guest. There is new blood.
Oh, what?
New blood for one of my anecdotes. So when I was a zombie in the George Romero movie Land of the Dead, we were shooting in Toronto in December, and it is genuinely the coldest I've ever fucking been in my life. It was unbelievably cold. But obviously, zombies are dead, so you can't see zombie breath.
Yep.
And so we had to do this sort of zombie shuffle forwards, which lasted about 45 seconds. And we were asked to hold our breath for that whole time. And as a smoker, 45 seconds holding my breath, it's not easy. But by the end, I was like, the minute they went, all right, and cut, I was like, oh, God. So, yeah, it's another technique there.
I mean, how long did you spend on that set?
About 3 days.
3 days. Yeah. Wow. How many anecdotes have we got left from those 3 days?
It's just a tip of the iceberg, to be perfectly honest. There's still a lot to come.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad we're in Horror Month on the show.
There you go.
So let's talk about the film's messy post-production, because British Lion made the movie, but after it was shot, there were changes at the top. A guy called Michael Dealey came in, and he did not know what to do with The Wicker Man. Christopher Lee claims that Dealey told him it was one of the 10 worst films he'd ever seen. Dealey denies this, says he thought it was indulgent, fascinating, difficult for audiences, genuinely ahead of its time, but he says, I've made much worse films.
When did he say that, though? Because that a lot of what you read, and especially with the Neil LaBute one, which we'll come on to later, it sounds like retrospective. It sounds like people going, it's now revered as one of the greatest British horror movies ever made. Well, what I actually said, everyone, was it's just different. It's just different. I didn't say bad, I said different.
Yeah, that's definitely Dealey going back on what he said at the time. He sent it to Roger Corman, the king of independent cinema in America, because he didn't know what to do with it. And Corman said he thought it was somewhere between an art film and a commercial film, which meant he thought it could be sold to art houses and horror houses. Would you go with that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But
one of the major studios offered more money than Corman. And so he didn't end up with the distribution rights. So he didn't end up being able to shepherd it into American cinemas. But he did say he thought it was a bit too long. And that's when British Lion brought the editor, Eric Boyd Perkins, back into the office one night and told him to remove 15 minutes as quickly as possible so that we can turn it into a B picture against another film they didn't know what to do with. The aforementioned Don't Look Now. Woodward says it was, Edward Woodward said it was hacked. Hardy says it was sliced up like salami. And Christopher Lee said, I hated what I saw.
Which version did you watch in preparation for this show? Because I was going to text everyone, or message as it's called now, because I'm not a dinosaur.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What are the differences between the various versions?
Which did you watch?
I was going to message you and go, which should I be watching? Because yeah. I went on Amazon, and they actually, normally Amazon just have one version these days, but they had the final cut.
Yeah.
And then they had the original cut, and I watched the final cut.
Good. I mean, I've got both. I'm going to talk about both. Okay. So the theatrical cut was 87 minutes, this version that no one was particularly happy with, and the one that we would have seen first time around.
Yeah.
And there was this story about the original negative. Apparently that was sent to the vaults at Shepperton. At the same time, the M3 was being built. The negative was put with trimmings that they were planning to destroy, dumped into landfill beneath the M3. And so, yeah, people are driving over the Wicker Man, apparently. Well. Christopher Lee doesn't believe this. He reckons it exists somewhere and only a few people know where it is. Michael Dealey says, you know, things just get put in corners. It's a shame it's this film, though, as it feeds all the loonies.
These stories about what happens to films, you know, Event Horizon, the story about like the lost 40 minutes of that film. And apparently the story with that goes that they stored it for some reason. I think they were shooting in maybe Romania, and it got stored in a salt mine or an old salt mine in Transylvania. And the salt eroded all the negatives. And that's why we are never going
to
see.
It adds to the mythology, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. And I mean, that's certainly part of the legend and the myth of this film. An American distributor 20 years later decided that he wanted to restore what he could of The Wicker Man. And Roger Corman was the hero here. He still had his cut that they'd sent him. And so Hardy and Christopher Lee worked on the film and they ended up with the director's cut, which is 94 minutes. And this is when we've got the additional material, but it's all from the start of the film. So the theatrical cut, it starts with him arriving at the island. The director's cut, you've got the day you've got before he arrives on the island. You've got him at church. You've got him eating the blood of Christ, drinking the blood of Christ and eating the body of Christ. You've got him speaking in the parapet.
You could eat the blood of Christ, but it'd be black pudding.
Like. You've got him looking at, you see that he's got a fiance. And then he gets to the island. And the other addition is that he spends two nights on the island in the director's cut. Mm-hmm. And so we get the main thing here is the additional scene where Christopher Lee brings a young boy to Britt Eklund's window so that he can lose his virginity.
Right.
So rather than her being like an object, she's more like a teacher on this island. Mm. She's more like it gives her character a bit more agency rather than being the strumpet that they call her later in the film. Mm.
So this is the version I saw. So yes, this is the bit where she's leaning out of the window and he's like, "I present to you this young boy."
And you'll know it is because the quality is much poorer. I don't know if you noticed. The quality goes up and down when you're watching the film because of these scenes. And so then there was more footage found in Harvard. And so that became the final cut. But the final and the director's cut aren't really that much different. He reordered some stuff and did some things with music. But the final cut is what I watched. And that's the one, the director's cut, though, is the one that started breaking house records in America, this new version. And that's how the cult of The Wicker Man was born. And so Woodward says, if properly released at the time, I think it would have been a modest success. But the cult smash it is now is because of the history and the legend that's grown up around it.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right.
So should we talk about the movie?
Bloody let's do it.
But let's take a break first.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And welcome back. So normally we talk about the plot, the story a little bit, but I've decided to call this section Weird Shit That Happens in the Wicker Man. Because you know the plot.
There's lots of that.
You know the plot. I've pulled out 24 things, so let's go in order. Let's have a little discussion.
Where are you starting, though? Are you starting in the church at the start?
No.
Oh, I think you need to start in the church at the start, just because I've got a good point.
All right, do it.
I'll just do that, and then you can do your 24 points in a row very quickly. the bit at the start, because you know where he's... not only... Because I came from it reminded me of my C of E schooling at school. Did either of you go to, like, a religious school?
No.
Not really.
No? So it was quite painful as a kid, because you did have these, like, people, like Edward Woodward does, gives out this very... Very sort of like morbid sermon, like the body of Christ, the blood of Christ. And I was watching it going, I think I actually prefer that to what I had to endure at school, which was when reverends and vicars tried to update the Bible for a young crowd in the hope of convincing kids, hey, the Bible's cool. And the one we had, he used to take theme tunes from television shows. So he once started a sermon by going, neighbours. Everybody needs good neighbours. With a little understanding, we can find the perfect plan. Not just the words to a popular soap theme tune, but also appropriate from the Bible.
Yep.
And you, even at that age, you're like, oh, shut the fuck up.
I'm going to die of cringe.
But the bit at the start, the reason I brought it up is because it's quite interesting. You know, we talked about this, especially on the Castaway episode, the idea that a perfect film structure is supposed to start and end in exactly the same way, just with the character in a very different place, your protagonist in a very different place to where he was at the start. So this starts with him in his Christian ceremony, and he's talking about the sacrifice of Christ, and it ends with him in a pagan ceremony being the sacrifice to the pagan gods.
Yeah, he's also talking about Jesus being portrayed. That is what his speech is in the parapet.
Mm.
And obviously he's being portrayed. And I think that's the question I want to put to you guys. Like, which version do you think's better? Because obviously that does tie in with the finale. But the theatrical cut, where you don't get this stuff, I feel like you learn, you very slowly and gradually learn about Howie while he's on the island. I don't know if it's necessary, and I think it might be a bit heavy-handed, because you do get the clues that he is a Christian man religious. Of faith as it goes along. I don't think you learn anything additional in this opening scene. Right. And I don't know, I think it weirdly dates it, because once it's on the island, I feel like you're in this timeless place. But when you're back in Scotland beforehand, I feel like it's just...
What do you think, Paul?
I like the foreshadowing version.
Yeah.
I like the fact that, as you rightly say, the beginning is the end is the beginning, but in reverse. So I kind of like that.
Yeah, I like
but
it as well.
But I also kind of groove with Chris's idea that you find your own way, you find the character, you've not presented it all on a plate. So that's a really difficult one, but I think I prefer the foreshadowing.
I like the foreshadowing for the reason that if you don't, for example, know how just quite oppressive and depressing a sermon can be in a church, what it does is sort of go, actually, what these pagans are doing, which is having a fucking great time on this island, look how fun and freeing compared to how fucking boring that is. So it sort of works in lulling you into this idea that, actually, these guys aren't doing any wrong initially. Like, they're just having a great time, having sex all the time. This is actually better, so he's wrong.
You're absolutely right.
Yep.
I'm with you on that. Okay. I'm agreeing with Alex.
Woo!
Second time in 3 weeks. Because
I'm witness to it.
I agreed with you on contact as well.
I don't know how to react.
Just be happy. Be proud. The sweet shop. That's when I immediately recognised something was off. It's the sweets.
Yeah, very
What's
weird.
Going on with the sweets?
They're terrifying.
Weird. There's cake women, there's goats and hares, and it looks like a lovely sweet shop until you sort of give it a second glance and you realise, oh, hold on, we're not in Kansas anymore, there's something up here.
I mean, you don't need sex ed at school, you just need a pagan sweet shop, because you could learn so much about anatomy in there.
Yep.
The Green Man Inn, the pub where he's staying, one of these pubs where the music and the talking all stops when he enters. Personally,
a bit like American Wealth in London.
Exactly. I mean, they
sorry, yeah. No, the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I think it
looked like a good place to go for a night out.
It looked like a complete laugh. It looked like a right laugh.
Remember pubs?
Remember that new? remember that weird New Year's Eve we had on Croydon? In Croydon, yeah. A bit like that.
It looked like a typical night down the Phoenix, didn't it? You know, people hoisting each other, and anyway,
you've got the landlord. Played by Lindsay Kemp. Camp as
Christmas.
Hilarious. You know about Lindsay Kemp?
Yes, but do tell.
Dancer, actor, mime.
Yes, trained Kate Bush.
And David Bowie.
And had a
thing with Bowie. They were lovers.
Oh.
Yeah, famously. So he's an interesting bloke with interesting stories. But
I love the fact you added famously. That's out there. I am not revealing something to move us up those podcast charts.
But what a beautiful daughter he had in the film.
He did. All right, let's get on to the landlord's daughter, Willow, then. So the local, we meet her, played by Britt Eklund, and the locals start singing about her being a strumpet and giving them a woody. And they sing about what's between her legs, and she loves it, and her dad bloody loves it. He is cracking up at all this.
And I loved it right up until the giant guy with the massive beard in the kilt does that oomph behind her to the bang of the drum. And at that point, I went, too much. It's too much. At that point, you should go, come on. If I was going to pick anyone in here, I'd go for my dad over you, because look at the state of you.
Now, the women in this film, do you think they're being empowered by their sexuality in this film, or are they, as I said earlier, maybe treated like objects? Where's Vicky? Where's Vicky?
I think it's a bit of both. I think Britt Eklund in the film, she does feel empowered, or she looks empowered, don't you think, or not?
I think she's enjoying it. I think, like you say, she's enjoying that.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, it all seems very good-natured. It seems like they've created a bawdy song and she's gone, oh, I love this, carry on. It's not like they've gone, we're going to do this. And she's gone, actually, that thing between...
I wonder how often they sing that song in the pub. Is it every night?
No,
have they got the other song?
We get it, the bit between my left toe and my right toe. Yeah. No, I've got it. Yeah, I know what you mean. It was funny the first time.
But interestingly enough, I mean, one of the things we watching the film, it feels like a musical, doesn't it? You could almost treat the whole film as, because there's so many songs.
Well, Robin Hardy
so
said,
many repetitions of elements of songs.
I think
and
Robin Hardy
all work brilliantly.
Robin Hardy said he was making a
brilliant.
Robin Hardy said he was making a musical. I think Edward Woodward was making a melodrama. Mm. Christopher Lee was making a horror film, and I think this weird mixture is
the
part of
all come together.
Yeah, is and what makes the whole thing feel off kilter, because it's neither one thing nor the other. But I definitely feel like the women in this village aren't being judged for what they're doing, and they're quite a force of nature.
No, I don't think if you're one of the blokes on Summer Isle and you're also and you're there and they're like, do you want to just go out to the green and maybe get it on? Because there's loads of other people out there. It seems to be the thing around here. And you go out there and then the woman goes, yeah, all right. You can't then go, oh, look at you. Oh, too easy. I think everyone's kind of happy with the system they've got going here.
Yeah. I will say that the women are better looking than the men on this island.
Yeah.
There are some rough old faces amongst the men, and all the women are stunning.
Well, the other analogy I had for the green man was, it's a bit like the cantina on Mos Eisley, because they all look, they're verging on the freakish alien. You've got the giant sort of mammoth alien in the kill. You've got Lindsay Kemp, who looks like some sort of lizard alien behind the bar, all withered. I was like, it's Mos Eisley's cantina.
Christ, I wasn't going to go that far, but sorry if any of the actors in that film are listening. You mentioned the shagging on the grass outside the pub. I think that's in the final cut. I'm not 100% if that's in the theatrical, but we've also got naked woman sitting on grave crying. Was that in your version?
Yes.
That was a random element, wasn't it?
Yeah. Do we know?
Thrown into the mix.
I imagine you've introduced her because you know who that woman is.
No, just found it deeply upsetting.
Oh.
Just the weird imagery that's thrown in all the way through this film that really messes with your head.
Off kilter.
Yeah.
We'll get to it later.
Distressing.
But in the remake, he really tries, doesn't he, to throw in those random, disturbing bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you who she is in a little bit. I'll keep that. A little bit of suspense. I'll tell you who she is, because it's quite interesting who that woman is.
Oh, did you know? Or is it on?
He knew and kept it to himself. Yeah. Made me look stupid.
No, I'm just saying. I thought that's why I was asking, because I thought you were going to go, I'll tell you who she is. But no, it's coming up.
Oh, we've talked about the goddess of love scene. So we've got the maypole. We've got a very strange man singing about shagging while kids wave their maypole ribbons. while kids indoors are talking about a phallus and touching it. And
look, who's Edward Woodward in this room right now? Yeah. I mean, these weird kids talking about a phallus.
Well, it's degeneracy, it's indecency, and it's the corruption of the young. That's what our Howie is saying. It's an unusual approach to teaching.
It's free thinking. These are free thinking people. I mean, at no point did I think there was anything wrong with this. I mean, to me, he comes across as a guy with a stick up his ass who is completely unaccepting of the idea that people aren't following his doctrine and his religious beliefs.
And there's a more recent documentary on the Blu-ray that gets famous fans talking about the film. And Ben Wheatley, who directed Kill List, which has some parallels with this film, he's definitely, like, he makes me laugh in that. He's very much against Howie. And on the side of the villagers, and very happy when Howie gets killed at the end. He said, I wanted him to die.
Typical Ben.
But you say it's free thinking, but I would say when Howie finds Rowan's desk and what he finds inside it, that beetle is anything but free. So we've got a beetle on a string tied to a nail going round and round and round in a circle. So this is foreshadowing, because this is what's happening to Howie.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they're doing to him.
Clever stuff.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I was quite shocked watching it this time. Howie does free that beetle. He just slams the desk shut and goes off. Like, I'm sorry, maybe he does deserve to die. He's so upset about what's happened to that poor beetle, but he doesn't rescue it.
That's true. I didn't think of that, yeah.
We got some disturbing imagery in the graveyard. We've got a ruined church and a woman with an egg in one hand and breastfeeding a baby in the other.
Yeah, I did a bit of digging about that because I was like, that's got to be...
I bet you did.
Because was it Anthony? Anthony Schaefer did a lot of research about paganism and in preparation for this film. So a lot of the imagery and a lot of what you see is based on historic examples. Yeah. And the egg thing is related to Easter, which goes back to pre-Christian beliefs, which is where the pagans, they had a feast in honour of the goddess Astara, which then became Easter, because what the Romans did, and this is where it all gets quite interesting, the Roman Emperor Constantine basically was like, I've converted to Christianity. Everyone here is still a fucking pagan. So how on earth am I going to create Christians out of them without causing some kind of massive civil unrest? So what he did was just start to gradually work in pagan ceremonies to the Christian religion. So this worshipping of the goddess Astara became Easter. And then eventually people were like, oh, okay, so it's sort of a similar thing. And then he just went, and if you worship any other god now, I kill you.
Wow.
That's how it happened, yeah.
Wow, a bit of education.
He's really read into it, hasn't he?
Yeah, I'm impressed. We find Rowan's grave. There is a tree growing on her grave, and apparently her navel is hanging from it.
Is that what, I couldn't work out what he said.
No, I listened to it about three times. Right. I couldn't understand
it. We were watching as well. What was Bully say?
Nasty. Then we meet a girl with a sore throat. Has anyone ever put a frog in your mouth when you've got a sore throat?
Not to date, but having seen the film again, I'm thinking about maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I mean, if the evidence is, when it comes back out, they go, see, it's got your sore throat, it's croaking. I'd be like, it's a frog. I don't believe you. They croak anyway. It seems like very basic medical care.
Howie's heading up to Lord Summer Isle's house. I noticed just in out of his window, you see a penis hedge. Did you spot the penis hedge?
No. You mean penis topiary?
Yeah, there was a...
It's a
big...
todger topiary.
Oh!
The only reason I said it was I'd come up with todger topiary. We get the fire jump, which is some nude or nearly nude women singing while jumping over a fire.
Well, they're not going to jump with their clothes on, are they?
I trust the sight of the young people refreshes you. Yeah.
But this is the thing. This is why, at this point, you're like, especially with the speech that he's about to give,
yeah.
You're like, I kind of get it, because the whole thing seems to be sort of pointing out that ultimately, like, what Christianity has done is make loads of fun sex stuff taboo. And God, that's, you can't do that anymore. And this basically goes, you should and you can, because it's just sex and it's just your body, and just have fun with it and have fun generally. And at that point you go, fucking damn right, Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried jumping over a fire with your balls or whatever hanging out?
I don't think I have, no.
Do you mean whatever, balls, like we're not whatever. Sure. We're not sure what's down there. Yeah. Your balls or whatever you have, Chris.
No, have you, Paul?
No, not.
That felt like a leading question. So we meet Lord Summerall 40 minutes in, and I mean the hair is good, isn't it? Because we've always seen Christopher Lee with the slick black hair, and so it's just this huge buffon.
His hair's fantastic.
It's not his hair though, is it?
But it gets more fantastic at the end when his hair becomes the sun. Well, he's done. Hair was spectacular.
He said, it's not my hair. It's supposed to represent the rays of the sun, the golden blonde, the leonine wig. It comes from the emblem of Summer Isle. It's all very symbolic, representing Nuada, their god of sun. But quite obviously, it's not my own hair. It's a wig.
So Lord Summer Isle believes that Christianity's god... can't complain because he had his chance and in modern parlance blew it, which is a great line.
Great line.
And then we get a bit of his story. So I'll read you a little bit of the history of this island, because this is the most I've ever paid attention to it. So last century, or the century before last, I guess now, the islanders were starving. And in 1868, his grandfather bought the barren island and began to change things. He was a scientist, an agronomist, a free thinker, and he came because of the unique combination of volcanic soil and the warm Gulf Stream that surrounded it. So he believed he could grow new strains of fruit, but he needed to rouse the people from their apathy. And I think that's the key. So he gave them back their joyous old gods. And a result of that worship, the barren island would burgeon. To begin with, they worked for him because he fed and clothed them. But when the tree started fruiting, the ministers fled the island and the people were convinced. Then his father, and he too, learned to love nature and fear it and rely on it and appease it with music and drama and ritual, which I feel like is telling us they were just a family of con artists, really, who have made this up. And obviously, it's made up. Well, I think it's made up. But they made it up to keep these people happy, to keep them in their place and to keep them working. Give them a bit of sex. Give them something to worship. Give them some drama, some music, you know, give them parades and they'll be happy.
Yeah, I think you're right, because there's that bit at the end where Edward Woodward's saying to Christopher Lee, he's like, if they didn't fail because of this reason, they failed because you can't grow fruit on this island. They'll fail again next year. And Christopher Lee's argument is, I don't think they will. It's not science. That's just you going, they won't fail. I know they won't. It's like, uh-huh, all right.
And when they do fail next year, what's he going to do? I think he's just going to find someone else to kill and just keep it.
Well, the suggestion is, doesn't yeah, that was the...
It'll be him.
Yeah. That, I like that bit because it's sort of... Not, it doesn't give you any optimism for Edward Woodward because he's still, like, toast, but...
That would have made actually a good sequel, wouldn't it?
I think so.
As in, you know, Christopher Lee himself having to be... or whatever.
Because it's such a throwaway moment, but you're right. That this idea that the townsfolk will turn on him because he's made them this promise, and if it doesn't come through with this sacrifice, as Edward Woodward says, it's going to be you. It's going to be you in The Wicker Man next year, Christopher. I don't believe it will.
I like your Christopher Lee impression.
So, tangent here. I didn't know this. Probably common knowledge, but if it isn't, I discovered something new about Christopher Lee in my research for this. Did you know Christopher Lee was a heavy metal artist?
Yeah.
Yes.
He never shuts up about it. He's singing.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Christopher Lee used to come, I used to own or co-own the cinema store.
Oh, yeah.
Which was movie memorabilia shop. And Christopher would come in almost every week to sell us his autograph, et cetera, et cetera. And he'd regale us with tales of Dracula, et cetera, et cetera. And The Wicker Man was always one of his absolute favourite films that he's ever made.
I mean, was he pompous? I've got a section here which I don't think I'm going to read out called Christopher Lee being insufferable, but
okay, no, he was always he was always nice to us, but yeah, very. I mean, he was about 8 foot tall.
He's
very imposing. You know.
I think you reach a point where you become a legend and like you kind of get a free pass a little bit. I mean, he comes from a different era and like because he's so old, you just become more intolerant as you get older.
And his ego was definitely intact right up until the end. But what was his singing like, Ali?
Here we go. This is from A Heavy Metal Christmas from Christopher Lee. This is the little drummer boy.
Sounds like he's singing at the wrong speed to the music.
It's not far off Shatner's spoken word in terms of misplaced confidence in musical ideas.
I'm going to segue now into the bum dance. So... our hero, Howie, is trying to sleep, but Willow, played by Britt Eklund, is in the next room and she is singing in the nude about stroking him as gently as a feather and combing his smooth and his head. And she's banging on his wall. And he, on the other side, is just about ready to shag that wall, isn't he?
Yep. He's spurning her advances.
He's what?
Spurning.
Okay, spurning.
But what a song, though. What a great song.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Willow's song, isn't
it? Yeah,
yeah. And it was covered by, like, Sneaker Pimps. Lots of bands have done cover versions of that track. Brilliant song.
So this is a direct lift, this scene, from Ritual by David Pinner, one of the many scenes that he said, this is in my book, and it's quite a specific scene, considering they said they didn't take anything from his book.
Weirdly enough, without having seen the movie, I Googled this scene before.
When I was 12.
It works for me.
And so there was this controversy around this scene because, well, Britt Eklund was just basically pissed off about it. Roman Hardy claimed that Britt Eklund told him that she had an arse like a ski slope, so didn't want to do it. So he got a dancer from a local nightclub in Glasgow, sent after shooting Britt's upper body from the front. He sent Britt off in a taxi and used the double to shoot her from behind in the nude, and she was devastated when she found out because she felt like this other woman's bum was much bigger than hers, and she refuses to answer or send back any fan mail that send the pictures to sign of that bum because it's not her bum.
Yeah, she says, so they brought in a body double the one day I was away from set. No one told me, neither before nor after it happened. The first I knew about it was when the film came out and I was in a state of shock. Now, bearing in mind, like, this other bottom does belong to another human being. It is their bottom, like you say, a Glaswegian stripper by the name of Lorraine Peters. Lorraine Peters.
Does she do the convention circuit, Alex?
I'm not sure if she does, but okay. I will certainly find out.
Paul's got a glint in his eye. Have you met Lorraine, Paul?
No. It'd be hard to disprove that, wouldn't it? That was my bum in 1973.
But, I mean, I just think you've got to be delicate when you're talking about another woman's posterior. Yeah. And what Britt Eklund actually said was, I shot myself in the foot by not doing it because they put in the biggest, ugliest bottom in the world. Which is a little insensitive.
And not true. No.
But also, Lorraine Peters is the woman on the grave.
Oh, no.
Callback. That is Lorraine Peters. Oh. Yeah.
That is good. That is good,
yeah,
Alex.
That's good.
He knew it was coming, you see. I just sort of slightly connected to this, there were rumours that Rod Stewart tried to buy and bury the Wicker Man because he was with Britt Eklund at the time and heard about these nude scenes and didn't want anyone to
perhaps
see them.
He was going to try and buy and bury it in the underneath the motorway where the original...
When you're on the M3, you're driving over Britt Eklund's bum.
So watching the film a second time, there's a scene in a library where Howie is learning about the spring ceremony, and that's one of those scenes where, guess what, we're telling you exactly what's going to happen in this film. You better be paying attention. So he's told that these May Day ceremonies include many alarming characters, a man-animal, a hobby horse who canters at the head of the procession, charging at the girls, a man-woman who is the sinister teaser, who is played by the community leader, and a fool punch, the simpleton who becomes king for a day. And he's even told, he even reads out loud that the sacrifice is sometimes a human being who was burned in a sacrificial bonfire. Unfortunately, this makes him think that this is what's going to happen to Rowan, so he's not seeing that this is what's going to befall himself. We got people popping up in bushes with animal masks on.
Yeah, that's a bit creepy. I didn't like that. I found that unnerving. Mm.
And that's repeated in the Wicker Man remake as well. We see the hobby horses in town and it's all sort of happening around him. But he's so desperate to find Rowan. And as Alex says, he's so convinced that he is right and everyone around him is wrong that he's just going towards, he's running towards his
fate.
What
do you think his motivation is? Because obviously in the sequel, they give him a real motivation. Not the sequel, the remake with Nicolas Cage. Why is he so obsessed in this with finding Rowan? Why do you think he doesn't just trust the community? Or why is he so persistent in meddling with something he shouldn't be?
Because he thinks he's one step ahead of them.
Right.
That he knows they're all lying to him and he knows that they're going to kill her. And so he's a good Christian man who's going to save this little girl's life. He's figured it out in his head.
The thing I like most is the fact that he does try and leave eventually and he can't. Because it's that age-old like horror trope where you're like, at what point do you not sort of go, you know what, this feels like it's getting out of hand. I might take my seaplane and fuck off and get backup or anything else.
But guys, what point would you have left the island? Would it have been the cake shop or would it have been the pub? Or when would you have gone?
Well, bearing in mind I don't share his values, I'd have stuck around forever. I'd have been like, this place is freaking awesome.
I would have probably left just after I'd shagged Willow.
There you go.
Oh, come on.
What? Oh, are you telling me you wouldn't?
I feel like someone has to say what Vicky would be saying right now. Oh, come on.
So we've got a fun scene where he's running around town searching for Rowan. There's Punch and Judy dolls in compromising positions. There's a woman naked in a bath. There's something called the Salmon of Knowledge.
That was Ingrid Pitts.
Yep. There was the Salmon.
She's not just naked in a bath. She's having a little.
I'm sorry. What?
She's having a little.
She's
touching. She's got her hand between her legs. She's enjoying.
I didn't study it that
I think she was. Oh yeah. I thought she was keeping her hand warm.
Oh, all right, Edward Woodward.
A little girl falls out of a cupboard, seemingly dead, but then cracks up laughing. That is very disturbing when that little girl does that.
You know what? Yeah, and that occurs again in the remake.
It does. And he decides at this point he's going to go for a sleep. And while he's having his nap,
hard day, man.
The hand of glory appears in his room, which is a hand, a real hand, with flames on the end of each finger. It's a hand candle, which I'm calling a handle. But that's already in use.
Yeah.
And
do you know what that really is? Traditionally,
you know all this. I like
Well, I did a little bit of investigation because I'm like, it's a hand. You've turned a hand into a candle. Why? So traditionally, in the pagan rituals, they were made from a severed hand of a thief who had been hanged to death. And they were used to prevent homeowners from waking during a home invasion or robbery. So that's where, the use of a hand of glory, the hand of glory.
Excellent knowledge.
Yeah. If there are any burglars listening, I'm not just in case we get into trouble from the police, I'm not handing out tips to keep people unconscious while you're robbing their homes. I don't think it works. And also, you've got to find a hand specifically from a thief who's been hanged to death. And bearing in mind, you are thieves yourselves using the hand of a thief. The chances are at some point in the future, you may lose a hand. So it's just probably ill-advised. Otherwise, it's going to be very ironic and no one wants that in their life. Carry on, Chris.
So I'll leave a gap there so we can cut that. So Howie dresses as Punch. He dons the costume and suddenly we're in the final straight. Ooh. And we meet Christopher Lee in a dress.
Hey.
Wearing sneakers.
Long black hair, a purple dress, yellow sleeves. Kind of look like, are they Converse trainers?
Yeah. I'd say Vans, but I don't know if they had Vans back then. They look like Vans, but yeah.
I thought this is a look you could potentially pull off for Halloween.
Already there. Yeah. I think what's great here, and you sort of understand, like, not only why this is Christopher Lee's favourite role, but how good he is in that role. Because
fantastic.
To look at that is to go, wow, you look fucking ridiculous. Mm. And yet his utter conviction in the way he wears that, actually, this is pretty bloody scary.
Well, Christopher was very well read in paganism and devil worship, etc., etc. He actually believed in a lot of that stuff. And I think he believes this is almost like a documentary.
Oh, God. Well, yeah.
What is your favourite, just out of interest, what's your favourite Christopher Lee role of all time? This is, by all accounts, his favourite role of all time. What are yours?
Oh, it's this, 100%.
This is your favourite?
Yeah.
I think so. Because he was great as Dracula. I mean, for us growing up, I think he was the quintessential Dracula. Mm-hmm. He was the image that you immediately pops to mind. But in this, I think he was brilliant in Wicker Man.
Mine is his role in Burke and Hare, the Simon Pegg and Andy Serkis dark comedy, in which he also starred alongside Tim Curry. And that completes this week's obligatory Tim Curry reference. Yeah. There we go. Done.
I also like him in Deathline, if that's a film we could ever, be allowed to do that on the podcast.
What's Deathline? I've not heard of that.
It was called Raw Meat in America, and it's about cannibals living on the underground.
On the underground. It's a great
It's a really good film, but really, it's weird.
Donald Pleasance being brilliant in that.
Yeah.
Writing that down. Deathline.
Recommended to the audience, to the listeners.
He's also very good in Gremlins 2, The New Batch.
He is.
And Sleepy Hollow, and of course, Lord of the Rings. And Star Wars.
Yeah. He's bloody great.
And many more. many more.
So we've got the sword game now, where the swords are going chop, chop, chop. It's quite tense. Again, this is one of the first time you watch it, you're not sure if he's going to lose his head here.
You think he's going to get his head.
Yeah, because actually they focus much more on the swords earlier in the film than the sacrificial bonfire. Yeah. And so you're led to believe that this is when he's going to get killed. But he doesn't. But he takes his mask off here and we start seeing how he's fear, because they reveal that they're ready for their more dreadful sacrifice, the sacrifice to those who command the fruits of the earth. And he's found Rowan, but Rowan was in on it all along.
Right, what a little shit.
Did I do it right?
Yeah, got in, didn't I? Yeah, idiot. She makes me so angry.
It's chilling, but it's now dawning on Howie what's happening. They tell him the game's over. The hunted have been leading the hunter. It is we who have found you and brought you here and controlled your every thought and every action since you arrived. And they explain that he was the right kind of adult, as I said in the intro. Free will, the power of a king, he's a virgin, he's a fool. And so they tell him, you will undergo death and rebirth, though the rebirth will not be yours, it will be the crops. So it's time to keep his appointment with the Wicker Man. And we see the pleas of this desperate man juxtaposed with the joy on the people of Summerisle. They're so happy. And he's so distraught.
But what's nice, which I think, you know, going a bit early, but the remake gets very wrong here, is there's a real naivety in the pagans or in the villagers, the townsfolk. Or maybe not naivety, but sort of like a genuine, like they don't see this as wrong in any way. So strong is their belief. There's no malice. There's no, like, they don't, it doesn't register as them as anything other than appeasing their gods. There's no acknowledgement, we are killing someone here. And the swaying of the arms as they're going along, you're like, actually, you know, you kind of forgive them because they don't, it's not like they're doing something wrong and they know it.
Yep.
He's trying to reason with them, but there's no point. They've gone beyond that point. And then he sees the Wicker Man, and that's when we get the famous, oh God, oh Jesus Christ, no. And he's not swearing.
Killing me won't bring back your damn apples.
But he keeps saying Jesus Christ, but he isn't swearing.
Jesus Christ!
He's speaking to his God, and his God doesn't hear him. And the reveal of the Wicker Man is so impressive.
Such a powerful image, isn't it?
And it's interesting. So originally, they tried all different designs. They originally filled the eyes with daisies, but it looked too friendly.
Of course it would. I'm the Wicker Man.
And then they gave it eyes, but apparently it looked too evil with eyes.
What?
And so they went with no eyes, no nose, no mouth, just the shape of a head. And they reckoned the blank face was ominous in a way that you could read into it whatever you wanted. And so that's the direction they went in. And so they needed the right light to shoot the finale speech. Did we say this earlier? They rushed to shoot it and... Woodward hadn't properly prepared. He didn't know the lines. So he's actually, that incredible performance, he's reading it off chalkboards that are being held up all round.
When he's in the Wicker Man.
When he's in the Wicker Man. Yeah. And he's being pissed on by a goat as well while he's shooting that scene. So he had a lot going against him, and yet you wouldn't know it because it's a hell of a performance.
Yeah, so powerful.
Yeah. I bet it smelt great. As well. Yeah. I mean, if it had been done for real, you got a lot of different meats there.
He said it was scary shooting it, though, knowing that this did really potentially happen. Like, he felt like he was connected to the past in quite a terrifying way.
Apparently, they nearly got in trouble, though. I think there was a pause in filming because the townsfolk, the real townsfolk who'd been working as extras, where they were actually shooting this, were like, they thought they were going to burn the goat. And it was a goat that they borrowed from the town that was a town mascot. And so there was a bit of a, like, what the fuck are you doing? And they were like, we're not actually going to burn the goat. So Robin Hardy has gone on record to say no animals did die in that.
Yeah, I read that Schaefer said this on one of the documentaries, that the RSPCA got involved and he sent them a letter saying that we will only be killing the cutest, woolliest animals. Sicko.
Get off the film sets. You've been here too long. You're not in the Wicker Man.
And I had the subtitles on to properly see what they were singing. And so he's screaming while they're singing about cows mooing and cuckoos cuckooing. It's really disturbing, this juxtaposition. And then that's it. The head falls of the Wicker Man. He's burned to death. The sun's setting. And you've got this perfect final shot that's just devastating. And so...
Unsurprisingly, there was, you know, when EMI got hold of this, and as you mentioned earlier, all the changes that they wanted to implement, one of the changes suggested was, unsurprisingly, a more upbeat ending.
Oh, wow. Ending, yep.
In which Howie's life is saved, and the plan was, that was suggested, was that torrential rain just happened and put out the fire that was consuming the Wicker Man.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, Robin Hardy apparently flatly refused this proposal, as you would imagine.
But the first time I watched it, I did think there would be some reprieve.
Really?
Yeah, it would have been the wrong ending, but I think it was just through desperation as a viewer, not wanting, unlike Ben Wheatley, I didn't want him to die.
I thought that watching the remake, because I was like, I wonder if they've really Hollywoodized this, and at the 11th hour, Nicolas Cage is just going to kick out, well, not kick because he's got no legs, but like crawl out of the Wicker Man and sort of have his vengeance.
I've got some quotes that back up a couple of things you said, Alex. Tony Schaefer said of this film, of this whole idea, I look forward to the day when we are pagans again. I think we'd have a much better time of it. I think we'd have a lot more fun.
Damn right.
And the director, yeah, Robin Hardy, said the idea that that rather happy, singing, lovely pagan society could come back and the only price was we'd have to burn the occasional policeman, it would be pretty good. So the people that made The Wicker Man really got into the swing of this.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting quote. I'm not sure who I can attribute it to because I didn't write it down, but it was about how when two opposing religious ideologies collide and there's just no way of one winning, as happens here between Christopher Lee, mm-hmm, and Edward Woodward, that no one can win this argument because they are both so set in their belief systems that the only winner in that situation, in religion in general, is whoever has the most muscle, which worked in this film because obviously he's got an army of townsfolk and it's just one cop, so yep, that wins out.
So what do you know about the sequel, if anything, that Anthony Schaefer wrote, Paul? So I'm not talking about The Wicker Tree, but what Anthony Schaefer wrote in 1989.
No, I don't know anything about that. We premiered The Wicker Tree film at Fright Fest
I wasn't going to talk about that, but how was The Wicker Tree?
It's not great.
But you programmed it at your festival.
But we had Robin and he was amazing,
yeah,
as a guest. And of course, it's a film that everybody wanted to see.
Yeah.
It wasn't great.
No.
I mean, it's worth seeking out. It's not a total disaster.
I was interested in seeing it until I think I spoke to you in Cannes.
Yeah.
The trailer's great. Yeah. The trailer makes it look really good, and it also makes it look like Christopher Lee might actually be in the movie for longer than about 30 seconds.
Yeah. And then he was working on a third one as well, wasn't he?
He was.
Before he died. And then also for many years, he was trying to do like a theme park, mm-hmm, a historical theme park.
Really?
Based around The Wicker Man, etc., etc., in the UK. He was going to try and, like a Disneyland, but...
Wow.
Go along and be burned. Or whatever. Fun for the family.
Leave your clothes at the door.
Yeah, I mean,
pagan theme park.
But you know there's a Wicker Man roller coaster at Alton Towers, don't you?
That must have been the genesis of it. Though,
yeah, two years ago, in March 2018, it's a wooden roller coaster that features a six-story Wicker Man structure that the train passes through three times as it bursts into flames.
I love it.
Lovely for the kids.
Mm. So the sequel you're talking about is the Loathly Worm.
Yeah. Right. So this is the synopsis. It was a 30-page film script treatment, The Lonesome Lambton Worm. It was going to be a direct sequel. It would have been more fantastical in subject matter than the original film, and relied more heavily on special effects. In this continuation of the story, which begins immediately after the ending of the first film, Sergeant Howie is rescued from the burning Wicker Man by a group of police officers from the mainland. Howie sets out to bring Lord Summerall and his pagan followers to justice, but becomes embroiled in a series of challenges which pit the old gods against his own Christian faith. The script culminates in a climactic battle between Howie and a fire-breathing dragon.
I love it.
The titular Lambton Worm, and ends with a suicidal Howie plunging to his death from a cliff while tied to two large eagles.
Sorry.
Fantastic.
You can laugh, it's fine. It's not happening.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Hardy, when asked about it, said, yes, I read it, it was shit. I'm not doing it. But the only other thing I'll really say is what The Wicker Man inspired, because... we got a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. I think the Burning Man Festival owes something to it, where people can listen to techno and pretend they are in Mad Max.
Said by a man who has never been to the Burning Man Festival. Yep. Apparently, people there listen to techno music. They dress in Mad Max apparel.
The Beltane Festival in Scotland celebrates all these pagan rituals now. It's popular with Wicker Man fans. But I'd also think that another thing really is the films and TV. I mean, without Wicker Man, we might not have a Kill List. We might not have a Midsummer. We might not have a Hot Fuzz. And, you know, some of my favourite bits in The League of Gentlemen owe a lot to The Wicker Man. So we got a lot of great horror from this, but also some really good comedy.
Yeah. And that was my problem watching this, in that I've come to it so late to watch it for the first time for this podcast. Mm. I have just sort of seen some of like the ideas that are in The Wicker Man, you know, that they've through osmosis filtered out into cinema in general. So it was familiar, more familiar than it would have been had I watched it originally.
And have you seen the Radiohead Burn the Witch music promo, which is the Camberwick Green version of the Wicker Man.
No,
it's really, really
good. We'll stick it on the old Clashpod Twitter, but it's good.
Yeah.
Cool.
Right, any more, or shall we do the bits?
Let's do the bloody bits.
All right, I'll start with Alex to give Paul more thinking time. What is your favourite scene in the Wicker Man, Alex Zane?
So obviously the burning of the Wicker Man itself and Edward Woodward's death within it is probably the most shocking. But because, again, I knew it was coming, it wasn't that shocking for me. The greatest scene, and I've been listening to this on repeat since I watched the film. I found it on YouTube. If you loved it as much as me, if you watched the Wicker Man for the first time in preparation for this podcast and you went, oh, that's a wonderful scene, it's this moment, which is the greatest song ever. And we mentioned it without mentioning the actual song. It's the Maypole scene. Have a listen.
It's horrible.
In the woods there grew a tree. Wait. And a fine, fine tree was he.
Here we go.
And on that tree there was a limb, and on that limb there was a branch, and on that branch there was a nest.
Alex is doing the dance.
And in that egg there was a bird, from that bird.
And all the children gyrating. So creepy.
wait for it. I'll turn it off in a minute.
So good. Break it down. Okay, that's enough of that. How good is that Maypole song? I know we haven't really touched on the music.
No, we haven't.
But it's like, I started off and I was like, ugh, I'm not going to be able to deal with this folk music. And then I started thinking maybe because folk music, you know, hadn't become a laughing stock as much as it has through comedy and parody in the subsequent years, it wasn't as laughable watching this with a 2020 lens going, ugh, fucking folk music. But then I started to get into it. That's why that's one of my favourite moments, because actually it's so off kilter. Do anything you've seen in a film before?
And it's Paul Giovanni who did the music for this film.
Sorry, I should say that. I do have that written down. Paul Giovanni is actually one of my best scenes, guys.
Paul,
the best scene has to be the ultimate scene, the end sequence. The so powerful. No matter how many times you see the film, it just strikes you when he first claps eyes on the Wicker Man and his destiny, his fate. That's terrifying, brilliant. Hairs up the back of your neck.
Yeah, I'm the same. It made me feel sick. First time I watched it, it made me feel like I've been punched in the stomach. Yeah. It made me, I think it traumatised me genuinely. Mm. It made me sort of, I watched this when I was about 15, and like, it just makes you see the power of film sometimes, that just how much this got under my skin. And then watching it again this week, I don't know, I felt real despair watching it. Mm. And I don't know if it was because of the film or because of what's happening in the world or because I'd trapped a nerve in my neck the day before and I was in quite a lot of pain watching it. But I just felt really depressed watching it. I think it's an all-timer as endings go as well. So, yeah, that's my one as well. MVW, most valuable whatever, Paul. So this could be an actor, character, a hairstyle, whatever.
A hairstyle, well, it's got to be Christopher Lee in the final sequences. Christopher Lee's wig.
It's the tendrils.
Where it literally becomes the sun, doesn't it? Because you see him earlier and his wig's down. It's like a normal hairpiece. Then it just becomes all manner of brilliance, doesn't it, when he's in that.
Wow, so you really did. You really are going for a hairstyle.
I just love that.
Awesome. I didn't realize I was setting that up.
Bewitching.
Love it.
But that's the right word. Honestly, it's hypnotic. You end up sort of staring at each sort of strand as it waves rhythmically as they swing their arms, the hair waves with it. And you're like, I'd follow that hair to the ends of the earth.
Oh, does that mean I have to watch it again? I've not really noticed it properly. I can't watch it again. Alex?
Edward Woodward. I think he's great in this. I don't really know him from anything else. I sort of read...
Callum? Was he Callum?
Yeah, that's right.
I did my Callum bit earlier.
Was he the sixth... what was he in America? He was in a big American TV
The Equalizer.
Series. The Equalizer. Equalizer, sorry. I sort of come to him in this. He's such an interesting sort of, in inverted commas, hero / anti-hero, because it's like only by the end do you realise what danger he's been in and how you wouldn't wish that on him. You wouldn't wish someone on anyone being burned inside a giant faceless wooden man. But before that, you're sort of like, God, this guy's a dick. And like, you know, so you almost feel guilty as the viewer by the end because, and this is all in his performance, like, because you've sort of gone, grow up, stop being such, why? These people are just having fun. And you're like, actually, I'm so sorry, you're dying. Okay, I feel bad on my sofa. So, yeah, I think he's great.
Good choice. I want to briefly talk about an extra that I mentioned earlier on the Blu-ray. It's called the Famous Fans Featurette, Worshipping the Wicker Man. And I'm bringing that up because the Talking Heads are fantastic. They've got, it's Ben Wheatley's one of them, Eli Roth, and what does it say? Oh, Chris Tilley. Yeah, Chris Tilley's on that featurette. So first and foremost, I'd like to recommend that.
I didn't see him have a go at me about Land of the Dead. Yeah, yeah.
I think we should give some credit to the Beatle. That was a tough gig.
Yep.
But I'm with you, Alex. I'm going for Edward Woodward. And it's lovely. He's not with us anymore, but on the Blu-ray, he talks about, he's so proud of this. And he said, I'm really proud to have done something that will last. And he really has. And part of that is down to his performance.
Absolutely.
And what would you change if you could change anything, Paul?
Well, we've already talked about changing the ending. That's the most obvious thing, isn't it? But the ending is just perfect as it is. I don't know. That's a really hard question, isn't it? Because there's nothing, unless you change the entire structure of the film, there's nothing you could change because it all fits together brilliantly as a perfect puzzle.
Okay.
So if Edward Woodward was enticed by Britt Eklund to go into the bedroom, etc., then everything changes. The entire film is totally different. No.
I'm with Paul on this in the sense that it really. I had to go through scenes of the film. I wasn't about to watch the whole film again, but I had to go through scenes of the film on YouTube to sort of actually sort of look at whether there was something that really stuck out. And I think the problem with trying to pick a change in this film is because it operates on such its own, like, lore of cinema that you sort of go, structurally, I mean, I might change this, and you can't because it's its own thing.
A house of cards. If you took one card out, the whole thing could just crumble.
That said, I do
in
have...
In a Wicker Man style.
I do have two. Not one, but two. First of all, I would change the fucking Britt Eklund body double. Not for the same reasons Britt Eklund has. I don't have any problem...
Would you bring Britt Eklund in now to replace that?
I don't have any problem with Lorraine Peters' derriere like Britt Eklund did. But it's just so jarring. Buy a better wig. Like, you sort of just... You watch it and it cuts to her and you're like... Well, who's that?
Oh, don't show her face. You see her face at one point.
Yeah, you see the side of her face, and she's wearing a wig that isn't the same colour and twice as long as Britt Eklund's hair in the movie. So I was like, it just took me out at the moment. The other thing I'd change is the minute, and I know I've just said I love the Maypole music because I love the folksy music. There's a bit where he finally discovers Rowan, the little shit, and they go on the chase through the caves, and she's like, come this way. And he's like, oh, cool, if I could hit you. But the music at that point, I could do without. This is the music during the chase scene, and it all gets very funky very quickly.
I've got to try and get your way.
Hurry, mister, please. I don't like it here.
Check that bass.
They're coming. Do you know what they're going to do?
Where's this come from?
Somebody tuned the guitar.
What is this music? Where's all the other stuff gone?
It's a mistake.
We've got a chase scene. Get the electric guitar out. Anyway, I could do without that.
Speaking of music, though, as the only member of the pod who actually likes musicals, I'm glad I snuck one onto the show without you guys realising. But there is a second song in the pub, though, that I could really do without. And I've forgotten where it happens in the film, but I think it's in the final cut. So I'd probably cut out one of the folk songs, and there was one in there when they're sitting in the back room playing, and I could do without that. And I would also get the bloody Wicker Man off the front of all the posters and all the DVDs. Let's remove that.
Yeah, but that's the powerful selling image, isn't
it?
You can't even see him in it, though. You don't know he's in it.
No.
I mean, you do know. I mean, it's called the Wicker Man. And you got to imagine that at some point a Wicker Man is going to appear. And it's not like they're going, Arrow, Edward Woodward in Wicker Man. You don't know he's in it. You just see this sort of striking image.
All right.
I think you're wrong.
He always tells me my bloody picks at the end are wrong.
Just that one. Not always. Sometimes. A lot more recently.
A lot lately.
I'm sorry about that.
Done.
You love each other really.
Spot it.
All right, then. Hey, are we doing a quiz this week? I never checked.
I've got a quiz.
You got a quiz?
I got a quiz.
You got a quiz for Paul and I. Yeah. All right, okay. Well, let's it's quiz time.
Oh, really? Okay.
Right. This film is about cults. So
quiz is about cults.
This quiz is about cults.
Cool.
So I'm going to tell you the name of a cult, and I want you to tell me if it is a fictional cult or a real cult.
Ooh.
So we're just jumping in here.
You both give me an answer for each one.
Okay.
The Ant Hill Kids, is that a real or fictional?
Sounds fictional to me.
I'm going
to
say real.
1 point to Alex.
Oh,
that is real. So they are a small Canadian doomsday cult from 1977, exercising absolute control over a dozen adults and at least 26 kids, most of whom the leader had fathered with his 9 concubines.
My kind of guy!
Concubines or binds?
The Brethren. Is that a real cult or is that a made-up fictional cult?
I think it's got to be real, but Alex is now going to say it's not. It's going to be 2-0.
I'm going to say it sounds kind of real. I'm going to go. I agree
with Paul. Real?
No, it's real.
You're both correct.
Hey.
Founded in 1971, the Brethren exists as a radical group that believes that the only way to prepare for the inevitable end of the world is to purify oneself by giving up all modern comforts and conveniences.
That seems to be a real thing for most cult leaders, as in, come join this cult, but give everything. I say away. But to me, I'll look after it for you. And then
I'll make sure it's okay.
Yeah. That's my private jet. Why?
The Cause. Is The Cause a real... And I'm not talking about the band. I'm not talking about the band.
Because that is a cult.
Is it real? Is it C-A-U-S-E?
C-A-U-S-E. Is that fictional or is that real?
I'll let you go first or something.
Fictional.
I think fictional as well.
You're both correct. Bonus point if you can tell me what film it's from. It's a film you've definitely both seen.
Runaway. No, it's not the band.
Cause? No.
It is...
Clues to the film, Chris.
Yeah.
It might have won an Oscar or two.
Oh, my God.
It's by sort of maybe the greatest American director at work today.
Is it Paul?
Yeah.
Oh, is it... Not There Will Be
The
Blood.
Master.
The other one, The Master.
The Master, yes. Correct,
yeah.
Alex.
Yeah. Well, I think
we both got it.
He said
all right, all right.
No one gets a bonus point there.
Okay.
It was a team effort. Okay. You both get
what
a bonus
do we win?
Point.
What do we win, Chris?
You wait and see.
Okay.
The T-shirt off your back.
The Cult of Thorn.
I feel that's real.
I think fake.
Correct. Can you tell me what film it's from?
The Cult of Thorn. That could be... Is it... The Omen? Damien?
No.
Thorn Industries and all that kind of stuff?
It's Halloween. Halloween 6.
Oh, which is probably a spin-off. Yeah, okay.
Fine. Ancient supernatural demon that dates back to Druids. So back to what we're on. Okay. All right. Halfway through.
I've just worked out the rules of this quiz. So if it's in a film, it's fake. And if it's not in a film, it's real.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So film cults aren't real cults.
Okay.
Got you.
Children of God.
That's a real cult in the real world.
I think that's real.
Yeah. Yeah, both correct. Yeah. Can you tell me any members? Former members, rather.
Madonna?
No, River and Joaquin Phoenix and Rose McGowan. Nasty, nasty business. The Freedomites.
I think that's fake.
Yeah.
It's real.
Oh,
you're both
really?
Wrong. Yeah, from 1902, they believed in nudity and anarchy. They would burn and bomb buildings in their birthday suits, which sounds risky to me.
Alex is signing up as we speak.
I'm just writing down things to Google. Freedomites.
The Necromonger Empire.
I wish it was real, but it's got to be a fake.
I'm going to say real because it might be.
I wish it was real.
It is fictional. Point to Paul. Yeah. Do you know, bonus point, can you tell me the film?
The Necromonger Empire.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
Sounds like something from either some sort of fantasy, maybe Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, close. It is Chronicles of Riddick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you keep what you kill. That's their
masterpiece.
I love that movie. One of the most tragic things in sci-fi cinema is the fact that film didn't do well and didn't turn into a trilogy.
Yeah, but Pitch Black was the first one was so good.
Pitch Black was good, but the Chronicles of Riddick just expanded this world. I've got a lot of time for the Chronicles of Riddick.
Yep.
Judy Dench, pff, great.
Don't feel like we have to ever do it on the show, though.
Okay,
that would be fine.
I'm just...
the final one. First Church of the Alpha Omega Bomb.
I think that's fake.
Oh, I think
I think I know which film it's from.
I think it's fake, but I don't think it's from a film.
I think it's fake. I think it's from Planet of the Apes.
Paul is our winner.
Oh!
Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Paul. Good knowledge at the end. Well played, Paul.
Congratulations. Oh,
cracking guest.
Right. Well, that is us done on this episode. But we have to look ahead. First of all, we're looking ahead to next week's films. It's week two of our special Clash of the Titles Halloween Countdown, and it's Chris's choices. So, Chris, tell me what your clue is for next week's pairing.
Idle Hands are the Devil's Workshop.
Idle Hands are the Devil's Workshop. Once again, I don't know why I write them down, but I've written it down. Okay, Idle Hands are the Devil's Workshop. That is your clue for next week's Halloween pairing. And looking even further ahead this Halloween, our final Halloween pairing in the final week of October, just before Halloween itself, and touch wood, we all get to celebrate it in some fun way, is our first ever listener poll to decide which pairing we do. Chris, tell us more.
Yeah, we're going to let you pick from a few choices that we're going to stick on Twitter in a poll. That poll's going to be up for 5 days. And so we're each putting forward a pairing and we want you to pick the one you want to hear. And we're going with the theme of witches. So, Alex, do you want to say what your witch films are?
Yeah, I do. My pairing is The Witches, very witchy as the name implies, The Witches, ladies and gentlemen, versus a film I've never seen, and I really don't think I'm going to enjoy it, but it seems to be one of those films that I've been repeatedly told by friends over the years, oh my God, we have to watch this film. And that film is Hocus Pocus. Hocus Pocus. So I'm pitching The Witches, the Roald Dahl adaptation, versus Hocus Pocus, which I haven't seen. So that's the pairing I'd like you to vote for from my corner.
And Vicky is going in the direction of Teen Witches. She is pitting the film Teen Witch from the 1980s with The Craft.
Okay.
And I am going in the direction of Musical Witches. So my films are The Wizard of Oz versus Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Paul, right off the bat, which would you go for out of those three pairings?
I think, so again, it was, what was it? The Wizard of Oz.
And Wizard of Oz and Bedknobs, Teen Witch and The Craft, The Witches and Hocus Pocus.
Oh, The Craft.
Do you see?
Sorry, guys.
No,
sorry.
I'm a bit torn between mine and Vicky's. I don't want Chris's, but I've never seen The Craft, and again, yeah, it's another movie that I'm told
really
I bloody
cast.
Love. Yeah.
As Vicky isn't here to pitch it, I did ask her to say why people should vote for her film.
I've never seen Teen Witch. I must admit, I've never seen Teen Witch.
It's gloriously bad,
but in a glorious way.
I might be voting for Vicky.
So Vicky texted and she said, I said, why should people vote for your two? She said, oh, I can't do a northern accent. Because if Whit, no.
Yeah. Teen
Witch versus The Craft. No, I can't do it.
Oh, right. You mean, can you do it like that? I thought you meant, should I?
She said, because if witches are representative of female power, then teenage female witches are the most fun way to explore that power, marrying as they do deep-rooted allegory with a naturally rebellious nature and unfocused, purer talents. Plus, have you ever fucking seen The Craft? It's fucking amazing.
There you go. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Sold a scene.
Right, those will be going up on Twitter for you to vote for which pairing we do in our final build-up to the greatest festival of the year, Halloween. That is it for this show. And Paul, you are going to come back and join us as we go through the Wicker Man remake on Thursday, aren't you?
Yes, I am. For my sins. Yes.
I can't wait. That's going to be an interesting, let's just say interesting show. Until then, thank you so much for listening. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at ClashPod, or you can email us show@clashpod.com. Please do rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, or other. It is hugely appreciated. Back on Thursday with Nicolas Cage and some bees. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.